This is KCUR's Up to Date, and today on KCUR's Up to Date, Mayor Sly James discusses the $800 million bond proposal to repair Kansas City streets, sidewalks, sewers, and more. It could increase property taxes, too. We're going to talk about it on Up to Date, coming up after the day's news and the news update, right here on KCUR 89.3.
$800 million is a lot of money, but that's the amount of money that Mayor Sly James would like to see spent to shore up infrastructure the next few years in Kansas City. That means improved streets, sidewalks, bike lanes, and even some buildings. The City Council this week grappled with how specific it needs to get when it brings this issue before voters next year. Voters are expected to vote on the package in April. A supermajority of 57% is needed to pass it. Mayor James has more than bonds on his mind. The city just recorded its 121st homicide of the year. That's the most since 2008. Mayor Sly James is in the house once again. And, Mayor, it's always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. It's always nice to talk to you.
Tell us why you want to do a general obligation bond issue next year for infrastructure. What's the need that you're seeing out there?
When I came into office in 2011, we had $6 billion with a B, billion dollars of deferred maintenance in this city. This is a very large city. 318 square miles. We can fit San Francisco into it three times. We have 475,000 people. We have density of 1475 per square mile. Manhattan has a density of 68,000 per square mile. Los Angeles has a density of, San Francisco has a density of 11,000 per square mile.
Wow.
If you think of each individual as $1 contributing to the infrastructure, and we have the same infrastructure, then we're way behind the curve, and we simply do not have a big enough base to take care of 63 lane miles of road, 3,000 miles of pipe, all the things that are necessary to keep a city like this running. If we don't fix it, it's going to break. It's just like a house. If you don't take care of your sewers and your pipes in your house, it breaks, and then it costs you a lot more money.
Was there one incident that sort of spurred you to go for this now?
No.
It's general stuff.
No. If you recall, Steve, when I came into office back in 2011, one of the things I talked about early was $1 billion for infrastructure. We weren't able to do that because the situation with bonds and interest rates and things of that nature made it entirely too expensive. Our situation financially is better now. The interest rates are lower now. Money is cheaper for us to get
Although
now.
Although rates are going up.
They're going up, which is why we need to do this now. They're not going to get any cheaper. This bond issuance that we're talking about is for basic infrastructure. Nothing fancy here. We're talking about rebuilding some roads that need to be rebuilt. We're talking about taking care of bridges that may be unsafe. We're talking about flood control in areas where floods are a major problem. We've had businesses move out of the city, not because they didn't like the city, not because they didn't want to do business in the city, but they've been flooded out multiple times, and they were losing money all the time and had to shut their businesses down.
Does that lack of sex appeal here in the package, does it make it harder to sell it?
Oh, I think it always does. I think people always want to buy bobbles. But I think people in Kansas City are down to earth and recognize a lot of people own homes, and they recognize that if you don't take care of your plumbing, if you don't take care of your front porch, if you don't paint and take care of your roof, then you're going to have a problem with your house. And that's why we do maintenance. The city, look at it as a big house. We got a lot of stuff that needs to be taken care of. And the only way for us to really do it is with a bond issuance over 20 years.
Well, the question that you and the city council is grappling with now is just how specific to be with the voters before the vote here in terms of, do you need to have a complete comprehensive list of projects that'll be completed here, or do you want a more flexible approach and just sort of trust city leaders to do what's needed? You're sort of leaning towards the more flexible approach, if I understand correctly. How are you guys going to resolve this?
Well, I'm not sure how it's going to be resolved, but I think there's probably some area in the middle that might work and some methodology that might work to satisfy the needs. We cannot sit down and say that in year 19, we're going to repair X road and it's going to cost X number of dollars. To do that would be foolhardy because we don't know what the price of asphalt's going to be. We don't know what the price of steel is going to be. We don't know if there's going to be an emergency. If the Buck O'Neill Bridge, which needs to be replaced now, or at least the major renovations, if the Buck O'Neill Bridge needs to be replaced and the federal government doesn't pony up and the state doesn't have any money, guess what? Who's going to have to come up with that money? It's going to have to be the city. Because if we don't have that bridge as a connector between north and south, a couple of things. Won't be able to keep the downtown airport open because we won't be able to get fire suppression in there.
Mm-hmm.
Think about all the people that live up north and work down south, and think about all the people who live down south and work up north. Without that bridge, think the economy in this city would be damaged. We need to have enough flexibility so that if something like that comes up, we can address it, and that's the only way to do it.
But there certainly has to be a list of some set of projects that you know will almost certainly be completed if this thing passes.
That list already exists. It exists in the five-year capital improvements plan, and the reason that it exists in the five-year capital improvements plan is because it's things that we've wanted to do and didn't have the money to do. We've got flood control projects we've been working on for 10-15 years, couldn't complete because of the money. They need to be completed. We've got roadworks and connectors that need to be connected and completed. Haven't been completed because there's not enough money. We know what needs to be done. We can prioritize it. We can say these are the projects that we're going to address, but we can't say they're going to be addressed in 2019 and it's going to cost X amount of money because those things are still unknown and the prices and the things vary from date to date. So we can say here's our list of things that we're going to attack as our first level of priority, but we can't say it's going to be done this year or next year, and we can't say it's going to cost a specific amount of money.
Kansas City Mayor Sly James is my guest. So which people at City Hall are actually going to be the ones who decide what gets completed when?
Public Works, in conjunction with the city manager, will primarily be responsible for that. After all, Public Works is responsible for the infrastructure in the city. That's what they do. They have a long list. They can tell you the grade on every road and street in this city. They can tell you which ones are in the worst shape, which ones are in decent shape. They can tell you which ones need to be rebuilt, which ones need to be repaved, and they can tell you when it needs to be repaved. And as far as rebuilding, the ones that need to be rebuilt should have been rebuilt already, but that's an expensive process. But it's also for other things, too. It's for sidewalks, for neighborhoods. We have areas of the city that have great sidewalks, but we have areas of the city that have crummy sidewalks. And it's interesting, we should never be able to walk in the city and say, this is the poor part of town, we can tell by the sidewalks, versus this is the wealthy part of town, we can tell by the sidewalks. Everybody deserves to be able to walk in their neighborhoods without fear of tripping and getting hurt. It makes the home prices and values higher, it allows people to be more mobile, and it connects the city in a way. Just like streets are a connected arterial type of a transportation system, so are sidewalks.
There are different ways to pay for something like this, Mayor, as you well know. You can do the sales tax, you can do income taxes, and you can go to the property tax. You've and the other city leaders have chosen to go the property tax route. Why?
Because the property tax route is the easiest way to do it with bonding. We have to be able to bond this work out. Sales taxes would not generate enough money, to be quite frank. We're kind of peaked out on sales taxes, and we kind of need to make sure that we're not getting too high on the sales tax issue.
That's been the go-to tax for a number of years now.
Yeah, it has been, and it's been very nicely used to attack very specific issues and problems. But generally, when you see cities that are doing infrastructure work, high dollar infrastructure work, that's a geo bond issue, which is another reason why municipal bonds need to be remain tax-free under this administration, because if they're not tax-free, it'll be much more difficult to sell them, and if it's more difficult to sell them, the cost of money will go higher, and we won't be able to do as much work, and it'll take more money to do the same work.
So how much more is this $800 million bond issue? How much more would it cost the typical homeowner, someone who owns a $200,000 house, for instance?
Well, we look at $140,000 is kind of the medium price of a house, and we look at a $15,000 car, which is kind of the median. And on those types of numbers, it's going to cost about a difference of $8 a year for about 10 years. And then that'll accumulate over that time, and then it'll stop at the end of the 10 years. So at the end of 10 years, at the end of 20 years, I'm sorry, it'll be about $120 additional to the property taxes. But that's over a 20-year period.
How are you going to sell this thing?
Well, we're going to try to talk to people and tell them about what they really have told us already.
Mm-hmm.
We do quarterly and annual citizen satisfaction surveys every single time. Infrastructure, roads, streets, bridges, sidewalks, number one, two, and three.
So it's time for voters to put their money where their mouth is.
Well, people tell us those are the things that they want to see addressed. Those are the basic things that they want. And we're going to try to address that. We've come up with a plan to address that. We've also come up with a plan to address the other needs. We've got a federally mandated ADA compliance situation where we have to make the city ADA compliant, to make Starlight Theater ADA compliant, as a matter of just that one place, is about $8 or $9 million.
Wow.
Okay. Every curb cut in the city has to be done so that anybody on any curb in any place in the city that has an intersection has to be able to roll a wheelchair off of that curb cut. That's across the entire city. That's a monumental thing. Buildings that were built long before the ADA, in a lot of instances, have to be modified so a wheelchair or a device can get through there. And we're under a federal mandate. If we do not meet that mandate, then we will be fined some ridiculous amount of money per day, which, and believe me, it will cost a lot more to be fined. And still, we'd have to still do the work eventually. So those are the things. There's another thing, too, that we're looking at. Interesting example. I think City Hall may have been built, 1939, something like that. Never been washed. Never once washed.
Really?
No, never once washed. Windows need to be replaced. Never been replaced. It's crazy not to do that. We have to do those things in order to preserve the building. We have an animal shelter that people in town are crazy to have rebuilt. They want it done, but that's a public-private partnership. They're going to chip in money from the private sector. We're going to chip in what we normally would pay for a shelter on the public shelter, and we're going to get something better.
Yeah. Mayor Sly James is in the House. We're talking about this $800 million bond package he wants to bring before the voters in April. Your questions, your comments, welcome. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. How will voters ultimately know, Mayor, if their money is being used wisely?
We're going to propose, and I proposed yesterday at the hearing, that we do an annual scorecard or a report card. At the end of the year, we'll say, this is what we've done with the bond money, and here's what we spent. And then we'll also lay out, this is what we plan to do next year, and here's what we project it'll cost. And that will be both specific, but also allow for some flexibility in case something weird comes up. And we'll just repeat that process so that every year you know what's been done, what the amount's been spent, and every year you'll know what's coming in the next year. And we'll repeat that process until we get to the end of 20 years.
Yeah, I'm wondering about the timing here, because certainly the Trump administration is talking in big, broad terms about a major infrastructure package that might address needs all over the country. Why not wait and see what President Trump wants to do along those lines before jumping into all this with Kansas City?
Well, two things. Number one, I've heard every president talk about wanting to do something big with infrastructure, and I've yet to see anything big done with infrastructure outside of the stimulus package that was used in the Obama administration when he first came into office. There hasn't been any major investment that beyond that. It's been a major bone of contention between the federal government, the states, and cities for years and decades. That's not going to change. Number two, we have no idea of what kind of an infrastructure package he's talking about. Some people project and say that the infrastructure package he's talking about will really be nothing more than tax credits that go to people who do that kind of work in order to spur them to do it. But one thing we know about infrastructure, nobody makes a profit off of laying concrete. the only way that you're going to make a profit off of a street is to put up a toll or something like that. So we don't have any idea of what's going to happen. Number two, we don't have any idea of if something does happen, when it's going to happen. Number four, federal money is generally used on federal property. It might be good for the highways that ring the city, but we're not going to probably be able to get much money unless it's a matching grant or something like that, which we would still have to pay for, and we always work on those, to rebuild Warner Road or Broadway. It's not a federal road. And my suspicion is that if there's federal money being involved, a lot of it is going to go to highways and bridges that are federal or connectors between states, those types
Interstate of 70, for
exactly.
instance.
Exactly. Interstate 70 might benefit from it. I don't think Warner Road or Broadway or Brookside or Main Street or Northwest 62nd Street are going to be beneficiaries of much of a federal largesse unless we can do something with a block grant situation directly to cities where we match funds with that and then can do it. But in order to match funds with it, we still have to have the money to match the funds.
Just one question before a break here. Mary of Kansas City, Missouri wants to know, Mayor, any money to stop dumping raw sewage into the Blue River?
Well, that's always something that's part of our water system, but that is not necessarily something that would be part of this bond package.
That's part of the sewer project. That's sort of a separate deal going on right now.
That's the overflow control project, and that's something that's being paid for by the rates on water, wastewater, and groundwater.
Okay, Mayor, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll have about 15 more minutes with Mayor Sly James. We'll talk more about this package. We'll talk about the city's homicide totals this year. We've hit 121. What are Mayor James' concerns about that going forward? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the Indie Foreign and Documentary Film Critics gave us their best of lists for 2016. Here's a spoiler. They want you to go see Manchester by the Sea. That was yesterday on Up to Date. Join us on Monday. The Fed increased interest rates this week. We'll ask the smart money experts what that means for your investments. That's Monday on the show. This hour, Mayor Sly James is with us. We're talking about a whole host of things. The big GO bond package coming up in April. A vote expected that month. $800 million for city infrastructure. We're going to talk about city homicides in just a moment here. Mayor, there's already some opposition to the $800 million bond plan from Dan Coffey and his group, Citizens for Responsible Government. He's talking about a lack of details, and he says this: the mayor and city manager want what amounts to an $800 million blank check. Sorry, that dog don't hunt. That's what Dan Coffey wrote. What do you say to Dan, Mayor?
I don't know how it's a blank check when you can sit and look at the stuff that we're planning to do. You know, you can't sit down and specify what's going to happen in 2029. You can say we're going to be fixing roads, and here's a list of the roads that we're going to be fixing.
Right.
You can say here's a list of the flood projects, Turkey Creek, Blue River. We can say that this road over here, this bridge has been closed for 10 years. We're going to fix that bridge. But you're not going to be able to say that it's going to be done on such and such a date. We can give them a list, and we have the list. The list is available. But to sit around and say we want absolute specificity, that's not going to happen. It's an impossibility. And here's the problem with it, because the same people who are complaining that it's not specific enough, if we put in a list and say we're going to do this, it's going to cost X number of dollars and we're going to do it in 2018, and then we find out that we have to come up with $50 million for the Buck O'Neill Bridge, then what we'll be hearing is, oh, the city broke its promise because they said they were going to fix the road that's right near my house, and they're spending the money on this bridge. This is infrastructure. It's about infrastructure in this city. We're $6 billion behind the curve. We could spend $800 million on flood projects alone, streets alone, curbs and sidewalks alone. Excuse me. But every part of the city has some different type of an infrastructure need.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to address those things in a way that makes some sense for the entirety of the city.
Do you feel a need to sort of divide up this package so that each of the six council districts gets the same amount?
No.
Because?
Because you can't be strategic when you're simply dividing by six. That is a blank check. What we need to be thinking about is, if we spend money here, how big of a benefit does it create? And that benefit could be across one, two, three, four, five, or six districts. If we fix a flood program that borders three and four districts, whose money does that come out of? Four? Three? We need to stop this dividing by six mentality. We already have a divide by six process. It's called PIAC. That's exactly what PIAC is supposed to do.
PIAC meaning?
A Public Improvements Advisory Committee. There's money that comes through a 1 cent tax that's already there. It generates money. The money is divided by six. There's a city component, and then there's six council district components, and the people who are selected by their council members decide how the money's going to be used in their council district. That's already there. But this is a city as a whole. We cannot continue to simply think that if we divide by six and attack these things kind of in a uncoordinated, non-strategic manner, we're getting the biggest bang for the buck.
How certain are you that voters will be casting ballots on this issue come April? Is this thing, it's not set in stone yet?
No, but I believe that there's probably a very high likelihood of probability, which is a word I think I've heard with the CIA thing and the Russian deal, which means almost certain, that there's going to be a vote in April. What we need to do between now and January 19th is work out the ballot language. How specific is it going to be? What's it going to cover?
That's your deadline to get it on the ballot in April.
Yeah, and I think that's going to happen. It's just going to be a matter of what that language is, and that's a matter of negotiation.
Mayor Mike from Waldo writes this, "I prefer property taxes, that approach, because I can take that as a deduction on my income tax." That makes sense?
It does indeed.
Yeah, okay. Let's turn to a different topic here that I know you're concerned about, and that's crime. The city just recorded its 121st homicide of the year. Again, the highest total since 2008. What do you make of it? How concerned are you about it?
I'm extremely concerned about it and very frustrated. I'm concerned because there's a real possibility that the numbers will continue to rise. And that is as a direct result of our total inability to stop people who should not have guns from having guns. Last year, 2016, Kansas City, Missouri police took 1,200 illegal guns out of the hands of people. Next year, I don't even know if they'll be able to do anything close to that because of the change in the law. Our prosecutor prosecuted wrongful possession or wrongfully carrying a concealed weapon, maybe 400 or 500 cases. Not going to be able to do that anymore because of the change in the law. The gun thing has almost become a status symbol. It's certainly become a go-to problem solver. It takes a second for somebody with a gun who's in a heated state of mind, having an argument with somebody, to pull that gun out and shoot them. It takes a second for you to feel threatened and pull out a gun and shoot somebody.
You know, you've made that pitch repeatedly to lawmakers in Jefferson City, to House leaders, Senate leaders, and it's not working, Mayor.
It's never going to work because it's a matter of ideology. It's not practical. It's not practical. When you really think about it, this isn't about the Second Amendment. This is really about the gun industry. They make a ton of money during this. The NRA is a shill for the gun industry. They make huge amounts of money by instilling fear in the people and that they need a gun. And I don't have a problem with people who are trained to get a gun, but now in the state of Missouri, you don't have to go through any training to get a gun.
You know, there are some experts who look at this issue and they say, hey, if you banned every gun in the state of Missouri tomorrow, the impact would be negligible because there are already so many guns floating through the system right now that this approach isn't going to get you very far, even if you get it, man.
No, it's not. And there's nobody in their right mind who says ban every gun and take them out of the hands of people. That's not the point. The point is stopping people who should not have guns from getting guns. Under the new law, the sheriff's department that has was responsible for issuing permits for guns could stop a person they did not think should have a gun from getting a gun. And they did that multiple times. All of those people that they should have stopped and did stop will now be able to get a gun because you do not have to get that process. You can do it without a permit.
Is there something going on the streets of Kansas City that our listeners should be aware of? I mean, is it a gang issue? Is it a domestic violence rash that's going on out there, Mayor? What's happening?
Well, there's something going on in the streets of the country. We're not the only ones with rising homicide rates.
Right.
It's all across the board. There's a couple of things I'll say about that. The more, if you're driving down the highway and there's only one car, probably not going to have an accident. If you're driving down the highway and it's jam-packed with cars and some of the people don't have a driver's license and some of them are drunk and some of them have had multiple wrecks, your chances of having an accident are higher. Same with guns. Doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a car. It just means that some people shouldn't be driving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's one thing. Another thing is that we have great societal ills that we have never completely addressed. Poverty, lack of education, lack of jobs, racism, all of those things that contribute to putting people in separate boxes and categories,
right,
that contribute to people feeling hopeless and contribute to people thinking that having a gun somehow brings you prestige or respect. Those are things that no city that I know of has been able to wipe out and cure.
I'm visiting with Mayor Sly James. You know, Mayor, Kansas City has this comprehensive program. At least that's how it's billed, to deal with violence.
Kansas City No Violence Alliance.
You're taking the words out of my mouth. It combines a bunch of different agencies together. It provides support services to potential criminals. And this is supposed to be the kind of program that would eventually lower these murder totals. Is it working or is it time to revise it?
No, it's working and it's always time to revise it because we can never be perfect and we can always find a better way to doing things, but it is working. You have to understand what Kansas City No Violence Alliance is focused on and what it does. It is a focused deterrence program. And by focused deterrence, that means that we are looking at a very specific subcategory of the people who create and perpetrate violence, groups. Some people call them gangs. We call them groups because people think of gangs and they think of Bloods and Crips. That's not what happens in Kansas mm-hmm. City. We have groups. A lot of them are geographical or some other weird thing that clumps them together. Some of these groups are very, very young, 14, 15, 16 years old. KC No Violence Alliance, Jackson County Prosecutor, U.S. Attorney's Office, ATF, FBI, Kansas City Police Department, UMKC, Probation and Parole, and my office are the board members of KC No Violence Alliance. Our group violence in the last 3 years has actually gone down 10%. Hmm. What's gone up are the one-offs, the domestic abuse cases where people have a gun and kill their spouse, the arguments over something in the kitchen table in a family and son shoots father, or somebody disrespects your girlfriend on Facebook. You pick up a gun, you go find them, and you shoot them. You get mad because girlfriend or boyfriend have broken up with you, and now they're with somebody else. You get a gun, and you go shoot
them.
Those are the types of things that are rising.
There's also a group out there called Aim for Peace that tries to nip these things in the bud by, you know, getting out and being in the community, talking to folks who are having problems with other folks and trying to intercede before things erupt in violence. What do you make of that? I'm intrigued by the group. I'm intrigued by what it does. Do they need more support, more funding? Is this the way you want to go?
Look, I'm all in favor of any group that is out working and trying to find a way to reduce violence, and I think Aim for Peace certainly has a place in that conversation. They're an interrupter. They try to get to people who are engaged, or they hear something, they try to stop it from happening.
Yeah.
And they do that. The thing about Aim for Peace people is that they are really at the ground level in the
yes.
community. They have street cred, and they go out and work with people who they know are there, and that's very valuable.
So you like what they're doing?
I like anybody who's trying to do anything to reduce the violence in this city, and that's true of Aim for Peace as well. Absolutely.
Well, that's Mayor Sly James. Mayor, I've kept you just as long as you said I could. I know you got stuff to do. Always appreciate you coming in here. Happy holidays to you, and good luck doing all the stuff you're doing.
Thank you. I do want to shout out to African American Mayors Association. Yes. We have our executive committee and our board of trustees and our business council have been in town.
You lead that group. You're the president.
I'm the president of the group, and we had lunch at Bryant's yesterday. They got on the streetcar and went to Tom's Town and Think Big. We went to the Negro Leagues, Jazz Museum. We listened to some jazz.
Bobby Watson played last night.
Bobby Watson was rocking it out, brother. He was good as heck.
That sounds good.
All right.
Mayor, always good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate it.
Missouri-elect Governor-elect Eric Greitens has announced his choice to lead the state Republican Party. His pick, Todd Graves, a prominent Kansas City lawyer and former U.S. attorney. Graves inherits a party that is already dominant. Come January, Republicans will control 5 of 6 statewide offices and hold veto-proof majorities in both the state House and Senate. Todd Graves joins me now from Smithville. And Todd, good morning. Congratulations on the new post.
Hey, thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
Well, how do you improve on near perfection, Todd? I mean, there's nowhere for the Republican Party to go but down right now.
Yeah, that's kind of a problem. when you take over at the top, I don't know where you go.
Mm-hmm. How much of the GOP victories this year were due to Donald Trump's overpowering win over Hillary Clinton in Missouri? I mean, Trump won by 19 points, and arguably he pulled the rest of the Missouri Republican ticket along with him.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of a chicken and egg question because he did have a big effect on the Republican ticket, I think that's because of where the electorate in Missouri has moved. And I've been working in politics for many years, and I remember when rural North Missouri was Democrat.
Yeah.
It was conservative Democrat, but it was Democrat. And the suburban areas were sort of the Republican stronghold in the state. And now we compete a little more in the suburban areas, and the rural areas are solidly Republican, not only in southwest Missouri, which they were traditionally, but in other northeast Missouri, northwest Missouri, and other parts.
I'm wondering, how do you take the Republican Party and expand it into the cities? I mean, that's where you're weakest. Democrats, obviously, weakest outstate Missouri. How do you make your Republican Party more appealing to voters in the two big cities, and is that even possible?
Well, you know, the two big cities are not monoliths. First of all, cities have St. Charles was considered a rural area outside of St. Louis. Now St. Charles is an integral part of the city. Platte County, which is my home, was once more of a kind of an outpost, and now it's part of the city. And so I think one of the things we need to do is we need to compete a little more effectively in the suburban areas. Our supporters eroded there some. Certainly we need to do minority outreach in the other parts of the city, but the suburban area is a place where I think that we can pick up with a little effort.
So take us bottom line here. Where do you want to take the Missouri Republican Party, Todd? What's the direction and the tone you want to set here?
Well, first of all, the tone is when I was in high school, I read a book by George Will, Church of Virtue and Other Tory Notions, and I knew I was a conservative. And I'm a conservative, and I'm a Republican, and those things are not going to change about the party. The party is a conservative party in this state right now, and certainly, those fundamentals aren't going to change. But being open, engaging with others, bringing more into the process, even if they don't agree, I think that's something that we could all benefit from.
You know, people look at the party and they say, to some degree, and this might apply to Democrats too, but that Republicans simply aren't flexible enough. They're too locked down in terms of the kinds of people and the kinds of beliefs that will be tolerated. To what extent do you have to crack that open a little bit more?
Well, the flexibility on beliefs, I think all parties are some truth to that. They write down their beliefs. They define strong positions, and I don't think you are going to change that because that's the nature of parties going back to the founding of the country. But the personalities, I think certainly you can be more flexible and open up to other folks to be involved or participate, that's where flexibility, I would like to see that expand.
You know, Todd, you're a successful attorney. The job of party chair can take a whole lot of time. Why did you want to take this on at this point in your career?
You know, it's just fun for me. I love practicing law. I love the practice we built here in Kansas City. There's nothing about it I don't like. But I started out, dropped out of college my sophomore year, and went to work for a senatorial campaign. And 24 years ago, I was in Jeff City when the Republicans got wiped out top to bottom. And that's when I moved to the Kansas City area. And so this is sort of completing it for me. It is something I believe in. It's something I enjoy, and it's something I get a lot of fulfillment from. And the best part is my practice is going well. We like what we do. I have the time. I can take the time to do this and enjoy it and also maintain the practice.
Todd Graves is my guest. He's Missouri Governor-elect Eric Greitens' choice to become the next chairman of the Missouri Republican Party. How long have you known Eric Greitens, Todd?
You know, I've only known Eric Greitens for less than a year. I have
really?
A lot of friends that I've worked with over the years who were involved with him. In primaries, I've got a pretty simple calculation. I've now been around long enough. If I have friends and I agree with them, I tend to support my friends. I didn't know Mr. Greitens prior to his getting involved in the political process, but immediately after the primary election, I came on board, got supported him, and I've been involved in the transition. Our law firm's acting as general counsel to the transition team, and I can tell you that he's been very open to people. I see people coming in every day, to expanding the base. And when he says he's an outsider, he means it, which means that there are no insiders around him jumping into positions. They've got a wide open search going on.
So you didn't support him in the GOP primary, the four-way GOP primary last August?
No, I didn't.
You know, Eric,
I didn't have a problem with him or any of the candidates, frankly, but I had personal relationships with the candidates.
Eric Greitens beat a quality opponent in November in Democrat Chris Koster. That's the political parlance sometimes that gets used. The big concern about the governor-elect is his lack of experience in elected office. You've referred to that here a little bit. He's never been elected to anything until now. How concerned should voters be about that, Todd?
They shouldn't be concerned at all. Funny side note, Chris Koster and I started together in the Missouri Attorney General's office in 1991.
That's right.
And so I've known Chris a long time, and we're prosecutors in Kansas City at the same time. Now, I know his experience, and knowing Eric Greitens, he's a sharp guy who seizes on issues very quickly, and there's lots of people involved in the process that have been around, and he certainly is not going to have any trouble being a successful leader, because you spend 10 minutes with him in a room and you know that he's a leader. Hmm. You have no doubt about that.
You know, you and your brother, Sam Graves, the congressman from Tarkio, way up in northwest Missouri, you know, you hail from there. It's a world away from Kansas City. What was it like growing up there? Because you're a farm kid, right?
Yeah, I'm a farm kid, and the funny thing is, to Kansas City, it's a world away. To people up there, this is sort of the city they claim. It's 2 hours. our family, I think, is demonstrates what's happened in rural Missouri. Our family were Democrats. We weren't Republicans by birth. My great-grandfather, Sam Graves, was a longtime county judge up there and was a staunch Democrat. I have a great uncle that never would vote for any of us because of his politics. And the real ironic thing is that same great uncle's son is the treasurer of Clay County now as a Republican. So I think the philosophy of our family and those parts of the country didn't change. I think the party philosophy's changed, and that's kind of the evolution of what's happened in Missouri. But growing up there was it was simple. I learned everything I needed to know from radio, because I drove a tractor all day every day and listened to talk radio. So,
You know, you ran for statewide office yourself in 2000. You lost to Democrat Nancy Farmer for state treasurer. At that point in your life, I mean, did you see yourself becoming a governor or a U.S. senator someday?
Yeah, you know, back then that was my goal. I wanted to run for office. I wanted to get on that track. It wasn't with the exception of Matt Blunt, it was a Republican year. That's the thing about these elections, especially down ballot. A lot of times, you're just you're riding the waves of whatever's happening in the country that year, and folks don't know. That track changed for me. I've been a prosecutor. I liked practicing law. My wife and I, we've been married 26 years, have a family. She was raised in the Park Hill area, and I had family up in the Smithville area, although I wasn't raised here. And we put down roots, and our kids have grown up here and go to school here. We love their school. We love everything about it. And that door closed, other doors opened, and this party chairmanship is just an opportunity for me to sneak back into that room for a little while.
Why didn't you run again after that? What was it about that election that you thought to yourself, I'm done, I'm not doing this again?
A lifetime is not that long a time, and I always thought of myself as having my own law firm. Growing up in a small town, we farm kids have a bit of a chip on our shoulder, a little bit, and want to prove something to the world. I enjoyed that, but I didn't want to spend my life pursuing the dream. I mean, I think Chris is a great example. We started out literally in offices next to each other at the same time. We're now in our early 50s, and Chris is didn't reach the governor's office and has spent his a great deal of his career doing that. And I saw the writing on the wall. It didn't work out. Matt Blunt was a rising star at that time, and I really liked Matt. And that was his star. And it's not like the world needed me to fix all its problems. And I moved into a much more background role and was happy to do it. Have been at the U.S. Attorney's job was something I love doing. I'm active in the Boy Scouts. I've coached my kids. I coached all three of my boys' little league football teams. I would have never done that if I was in politics in that way. So it's, funny how things work out sometimes, but it just that door closed for me.
Todd Graves, the incoming chairman of the Missouri Republican Party, is my guest here. In 2001, President Bush, as you alluded to a minute ago, appointed you as the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Missouri. You took the oath of office just 6 days after the 9/11 attacks. Why did you want that job?
Well, as a practicing lawyer, which, again, I'm a lunch pail lawyer. I do politics, but I'm a lunch pail lawyer. The nuts and bolts are something that I do and we do in our law firm. That's the highest job that you could possibly have. As far as I'm concerned, there is no greater job in the business of law than being the United States District Attorney in your home community. And after 9/11, it was certainly interesting. John Ashcroft, U.S. Attorney General, his chief of staff was someone that I'd known back at the zoo in college, so I was able to, be really involved in what was going on in Washington. Had a ball, tried important cases, I can remember standing in the well of the federal courthouse before I gave a death penalty case argument, and the sun was streaming through the windows up above, and it was a case that moved me personally, and thinking, I don't know that I will ever reach a higher point in a professional career than I have today. Hmm. And that job is a job to love. It really is. But it's also, like all things, there's a time and a season, and that time and a season came and went. And I look back on it fondly, but I love what I'm doing now, even more.
Well, let's talk about that season that came to an end, because toward the end of your time there, Todd, you became embroiled in a controversy, and I should point out it was not of your own making. When your name appeared on a list of U.S. attorneys who were to be dismissed, you had clashed with the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division over a federal lawsuit involving Missouri's voter rolls. The department was pushing for a lawsuit against Missouri, accusing the state of failing to eliminate ineligible people from voter rolls, but you refused to sign off on the suit, and as a result, your name showed up on this list. The whole situation here sounds to me like a politics just run amok.
Yeah, I who knows, Steve? Those things, everything you said happened, but in politics, it's just. It's amazing to me, people get appointed a high position and they don't realize that there's a bit of chance and luck in that. And certainly you have to be qualified, but I was selected for that position. I was the right person at the right time at the right place. Did a good job, and then later on, I wasn't at the right time, the right place, for whatever reason. It wasn't my time anymore, and I don't take myself too seriously. I did that job with earnestness. I did it to the best of my ability. And if I was out of favor politically for one reason or another, and you know, you never really know about those things. Fine, you know, that's okay too, and I moved on. It's kind of, politics is funny that way sometimes.
That's Todd Graves. He's the incoming chair of the Missouri Republican Party. Todd, thank you very much. Good luck in the new job. Appreciate your time.
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve.
This weekend is a big one for players and fans of two local college football teams. The boys at Baker University are playing for an NAIA national championship down in Daytona Beach, Florida. It will be the first national championship in school history. Then there's the Northwest Missouri State Bearcats. These guys are the reigning champs of Division II and are 14-0 on the season. With us to talk about both teams is freelance sports reporter for KCUR, Greg Eklund. And Greg, thanks very much.
Good morning, Steve. How about those fabulous Baker boys?
I guess the bigger surprise here, obviously, is Baker University. Tell us a little bit about the kind of recruits Baker is able to get on their team. We're not necessarily talking about a team of giants here, are we?
Sure, we're not. We're talking about Mike Grossner trying to assemble a team that are not good enough for the major college level, yet still want to play football and are good football players. He has assembled guys who may not be huge in stature, but they can play the game, and they have shown that through an undefeated season so far.
The quarterbacks for both these teams sort of have some ties to the Kansas City area. Tell us about that.
Well, both of them are from Blue Valley High School, and both of them led their team to respective state titles. The Logan Bertel is the quarterback at Baker, and he succeeded the quarterback who is now at Northwest Missouri. His name escapes me for the moment, but it's a unique story where each starting quarterback is from the same high school with a chance to win a national championship at two different colleges.
I'm guessing the alumni and the students at both these schools have to be just crazy excited here.
Well, and there were 17,000 people at Children's Mercy Park last season for this championship game in Kansas City, Kansas. And I know NCAA officials are hoping that the Northwest Missouri Bearcats turn out in numbers again there. And from what I understand, there has been a solid amount of Baker fans who have traveled to Florida down to Daytona Beach to see the Baker Wildcats shoot for their
and get out of this cold weather here. How can you blame them, Greg? I should point out that both games will be on ESPN this weekend. 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock on ESPN2, Northwest Missouri State, 6 o'clock on ESPN3 for the Baker game. Greg, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Steve.
Monday on the show, the smart money experts are here. Our theme music is composed by Bobby Watson. We had help this week from KCUR's Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.